The 1999 murder of Haman Lee in Baltimore, Maryland, and the prosecution and conviction of Adnan Syed and her murder has now been documented in multiple podcasts with dozens and dozens of episodes. It's been written about in hundreds of articles. It's been covered by every major news outlet and has launched a global movement for justice. And yet, there is much more to the story, including Adnan's own telling of it. St. Martin's Press brings you Adnan's Story, Murder, Justice, and the Case That Captivated a Nation, the first and seminal book about the case that I was honored to write with contributions from Adnan himself. The book releases September 6, 2016, but is already available for pre-order. Go to www.adnanstory.com to place your order and reserve your copy today. This week's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by Stamps.com. Mailing and shipping can seem like a no-win situation. The post office takes way too much time, and a postage meter is pretty expensive. Fortunately, there's a better way, Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code Undisclosed for this special offer. You get a four-week trial and $110 in bonuses, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Undisclosed. That's Stamps.com and enter Undisclosed.
Hello and welcome to another special episode of Undisclosed. This is Colin Miller, Associate Dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law and blogger at Evidence Prof Blog. Today's episode is Wrongful Convictions. The Center for Wrongful Convictions is housed at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law, and it's helped to facilitate a number of criminal justice reforms, including the abolition of Illinois' death penalty in 2011. The center has special units that deal with the wrongful convictions of women and youth, including their current representation of Brandon Dassey for making a murderer. When the center was founded in 1999, wrongful convictions were thought to be an anomaly. Now, in the wake of recent media and events, we can see that that's not really the case. Today, I speak to Karen Daniel, the director of the Center for Wrongful Convictions, about the reasons why we have so many wrongful convictions and what we can do to cure those ills. Now, Karen, let's start with the early days of your career. After you graduated from Harvard Law School, you were an appellate defender in Chicago for a number of years. How did you find that experience?
Well, I love that job. I am a defense-minded person by nature, so I enjoy the challenge of representing people in difficult circumstances. And I love the cerebral aspect of working on appeals because I was not in a courtroom every day. I was reading transcripts, doing legal research, writing, and arguing appeals. And it was a great way to get to know what was going on in the legal system, what the problems and issues were, and a great way to get to know what was going on in the city through reading all these different transcripts. So it was a wonderful job. I loved it.
And then after a few years in private practice, as I said, you are now the director of the Center of Wrongful Convictions, and that's part of the Bloom Legal Clinic at Northwestern. And can you tell me a bit about that Bloom Legal Clinic?
Yes, we have at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, in my opinion, the best legal clinic in the country because it's a very large legal clinic. It's been going for many decades, and we have a lot of different centers that do just fantastic work in a lot of different areas. We do wrongful conviction work, as you know. We do trial-level criminal defense. We have a children and family justice center that's amazing and represents juveniles and families in many different contexts, including juvenile court, immigration matters. We have a civil rights clinic. We have a civil law clinic. We have an entrepreneurship clinic that represents startup businesses and small business owners. And I'm probably missing a few, but I think that gives you an idea of the breadth of our clinic. And at any given time, we have around 250 of our law students enrolled in our clinical programs.
Yeah, and you're the director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions, and your website, I think, is a great resource in terms of looking at the sources of wrongful convictions that we see across the country. I think with the Innocence Project and DNA testing, it's been easy to identify these various categories that these wrongful convictions fall into. And I wanted to go through some of those causes and sort of talk through those issues with you. The first is eyewitness misidentifications. Your center has represented a few people where wrongful identifications have played a factor. So, for instance, there was one, Dean Cage, where it was a sexual assault case, and they made a composite sketch, and it was a cross-racial identification. There was an anonymous tip. And one particular problem that's been identified is the problems with cross-racial identifications. And what is the issue there when you have, say, an eyewitness of a certain race and they're identifying someone of a different race?
One of the interesting things about eyewitness issues is that it's an area that can be researched by social scientists. And social scientists have set up really great and creative experiments to look at what factors can result in errors in identification. And so the cross-racial difficulties of making an identification is something that's been studied in some depth. And the results of the studies are simply that it is more difficult for people to identify someone of a different race than someone of their own race. So it's a simple concept, and it does play a factor in many of the wrongful convictions that we've worked on and that have been uncovered across the country.
And I know you wrote a piece after the Pixar movie Inside Out came out last year where it depicted a certain representation of memory as sort of taking these almost mental photographs that become entrenched in a person's mind. And that's not really the way the memory works, right?
No, not at all. And I mean, it was a fun piece because I happen to really love Pixar movies. But in that particular Pixar movie, a person's memories were depicted as being perfectly preserved in little globes that could be taken off the shelf at any time and looked at and put back. A lot of people similarly think that memory is like a DVR or a DVD. It's something that I've learned in my career that is absolutely not the case. And in fact, nothing could be farther from the truth, that a certain event can be encoded in your memory, but over time, based on various factors, your actual memory can change. And so when you reflect back on that event, you might not be reflecting on what actually happened. You might be reflecting on something else that has happened in between the original event and when you're reflecting back on it. You know, I'll give you an example that I love because it's not related to criminal law. But one experiment that was done had to do with talking to people about visits they'd made when they were children to Disneyland. So the researchers were asking these subjects, well, when you were at Disneyland, did you get to see, I think it was Bugs Bunny. Did you talk to Bugs Bunny? What did Bugs Bunny say to you? And so on and so forth. And by asking those questions, the subjects, many of them reported back on seeing Bugs Bunny and having conversations with him. And of course, Bugs Bunny's not a Disney character, so Bugs Bunny was never at Disneyland. But the subjects, because of the way they were questioned, their memories of their childhood visits to Disneyland absolutely changed. And experiments like that have been done across the board in a lot of different contexts. And so we've learned that the way questions are asked, the things that, say, in the criminal context, police officers say to witnesses, photographs that they look at, all those things can change your memory in a way that sometimes the witness, him or herself, isn't even aware of. And so the thing you think you're remembering, you can be positive that you're remembering it. You can be very honest about what you're reporting, and it can just be wrong.
Yeah, and another factor in that, which your organization has recognized, is that in addition to changing the protocol from the six-person lineup where you're comparing the features of different people, is also it being a double blind because, right, a huge problem is when the officer conducting the lineup gives a positive affirmation to someone who's picked out the person they've identified as their suspect, that can make a person much more confident of their memory than they were before the identification, right?
Yes, that's called post-identification feedback. So that's one danger of having the officer who's running the lineup know who the suspect is that right afterwards, the officer might say, good job, you got the person. But also, even during the lineup procedure, if the officer running the lineup or the photo identification procedure knows who the suspect is, if the officer is not ethical, the officer can, of course, do something subtle or not so subtle to point out the police suspect. But even if the officer is honest and is trying to do a good job, the officer might just subconsciously be sending signals to the witness, could be perhaps lingering a little bit longer on one suspect or another, or perhaps suggesting to the witness that they take a second look at a particular line of participant. And so not intentionally trying to sway the identification, but maybe subconsciously doing that. So if the person running the lineup doesn't know who the suspect is, you take that out of there. And in those instances now in which we have investigators going out into the field and showing photographs to witnesses, that's how we do it now. We might give a set of photographs to our investigator, and we don't tell the investigator who our suspect is. And it's kind of fun. Actually, the investigator comes back and can't wait to find out if the witness identified our suspect or not, but it just makes it impossible for the investigator to influence the lineup.
Yeah, it's sort of bringing the scientific method into identification, and that brings me then to the second main cause of wrongful convictions, which is the flawed forensic science. And I know that your center has represented many people where flawed forensics have played a role. So, for instance, there's been a lot of questions about the techniques used by arson investigators. There's been reports about comparative bullet lead analysis being flawed, hair testing, bite mark patterns, etc. What have you encountered in your career, and what do you think can be done to correct some of these flawed forensics that are entering the courtroom? And in many cases, based upon popular media, CSI, etc., people placing a great deal of weight in them.
Well, we have encountered many of those things. We did represent a client named Christine Bunch. Christine was convicted of arson and murder after her trailer home went up in flames and her three-year-old son died in the fire, and Christine got out. And the reasoning of the law enforcement authorities was, well, she got out and her son didn't, so she must have set the fire. This was in the mid-90s, and at that time, the fire investigators, as you said, looked at the trailer home where she lived. A couple of the rooms had completely gone up in flames, and they did what they had learned when they were trained to be fire investigators by the people before them. And it was kind of an apprenticeship system. So, you know, a fire investigator would be trained and would learn from fire investigators before him or her and so on back through the generations. And they were taught that certain burn patterns meant that a liquid accelerant had been poured and that certain patterns on the wall were points of origins for the fire. And those myths were just perpetuated. And based on that analysis, which was the only analysis that they had at their disposal, in Christine Bunch's case, this was an Indiana case, they concluded that she had intentionally set the fire. But right around the 80s and the 90s, people started actually testing these hypotheses and doing actual experiments. Again, we're getting back to science and doing experiments. And what was learned was that if you did controlled burns, you cannot distinguish between an intentionally set fire or an accidental fire. There's a certain point called flashover when the room on fire is just completely in flames. If you get beyond that point, you can't tell the difference. And that has thrown into question hundreds of arson convictions across the country that were based on these mistaken notions of what an arson fire looks like. So in my client Christine Bunch's case, she lost her three-year-old son, and she was a loving mom. She was, you know, no history of abuse, no history of mental illness, no reason to kill her son, no big insurance policy on the house, nothing like that. And this tragedy falls, and she's suspected, she's convicted based on what the fire investigators said. And she goes to prison pregnant with her second child, who's taken away from her after he was born in prison. And she was away for 17 years. And now we know that the entire basis of her conviction was completely faulty.
Right, and she has a current lawsuit out there under the Federal Tort Claims Act, which raises another issue with wrongful convictions, and that is state misconduct, because my understanding is that her claim is that the ATF forensic chemist William Kennard initially did testing and didn't find the pattern of accelerants. And as you said, there are questions about whether that pattern would be indicative of arson anyway, but that the officers there, the fire marshals involved, had him change his report a bit and didn't disclose that initial report to the defense. And what have you seen in terms of that, where it's this relationship between law enforcement, which obviously, although representing the public, is geared toward trying to secure convictions, and that relationship with expert witnesses who are supposed to be objective and neutral?
First of all, I never like to be seen as anybody who either bashes prosecutors or police officers or law enforcement agents. For the most part, I think they do a great job and they're honorable people. But I do think that there needs to be a change in the culture in prosecutors' offices, for example, in many respects, but in two important respects that relate to the question you asked. And one is that prosecutors' offices need to have a culture where they don't simply accept the evidence that's given to them by their police agents who they're working with. They need to constantly be reevaluating the evidence throughout the course of the case as it wends its way through indictment and through the courts and even after conviction. And I'm not saying they don't all do that, but not all of them do that, and that needs to be done. And second, this was a problem in Christine's case. Not all the reports were turned over. There was some really critical, important information that was in the lab file of the lab analyst from ATF, the U.S. Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which did the lab testing in her case. And there was a final report that was turned over, but there was a draft report that was completely different that wasn't turned over, and all the raw data was not turned over. And that information played a huge role in Christine's conviction being overturned, because that information was inconsistent with the state's theory at trial. So the lesson from that is that there needs to be a much more open exchange of information from the prosecutor's offices to the defense attorneys. And I really am in favor of basically an open file discovery policy, and I think that all prosecutors' offices should just adopt that. The way it is now, they get to pick and choose what information to turn over to the defense, and sometimes not everything necessary gets turned over to the defense. In the Christine Bunch case, I'll hasten to add that the prosecutor who actually prosecuted the case, he didn't have the file either from the ATF, but it is the prosecutor's duty to go out to the agencies that they're working with and find all the necessary information and turn it over to the defense.
Right, yeah, that's the classic Supreme Court case, Collins versus Whitley, where they say, yeah, in many cases there are well-meaning police officers, well-meaning prosecutors, and it's just that information exchange doesn't take place, and under Brady versus Maryland, that's just as much of a due process violation as police, the prosecution acting in bad faith. And then pivoting from that, sort of the classic scenario where, as you know, most police officers, prosecutors are trying to do their job, they're trying to uphold justice, and yet we can have, in some cases, wrongful convictions. The classic case seems to be the false confession, and probably most famously, former Detective Jim Tranum has spoken about a case where he got a false confession, and it wasn't anything intentional. It was just he was trying to conduct an interrogation, and it was a false confession. In many of the cases that have been handled by your center involve what turned out to be false confessions, and one of those was the prosecution of Nicole Harris. And can you tell me a bit about her case?
Nicole Harris's case took place here in Chicago, which some people refer to as the false confession capital of the country. We've had a lot of problems with coerced confessions and just false confessions here. We had a whole scandal of a group of police detectives who were beating confessions out of people. That's not what happened to Nicole, though. Nicole was questioned very shortly after her four-year-old son died in a tragic accident in her home. And speaking as a mother, I can barely imagine how overcome she must have been at the loss of her child suddenly like that in a tragic accident. And that's the state of mind she was in when the police began to question her. And I've heard her describe this many times, that it started out as questioning, but it very quickly turned into interrogation by the police. And those are two completely different things. Questioning is a conversation in which the investigators are trying to find out what happened. Interrogation is not that. Interrogation is a mission to get a confession. And Very quickly, Nicole was isolated from the other members of her family. Her surviving son, her five-year-old, was removed from her presence. And the police began to be accusatory, and they called her names, and they threatened her. And I guess rather quickly, she confessed. And she confessed to having killed her son in a way that, at the time of the confession, the police thought that her son was somehow strangled by a telephone cord. So that was in her initial confession. But it later turned out that's not how he died. They figured that out. He actually was strangled by the elastic band from a fitted bed sheet. So she made that initial confession that matched what the police thought at that time. Then she took a polygraph, which they said was inconclusive, and then she recanted her confession, and then she confessed a second time, and the second confession matched the evidence that was actually true, which was that he was strangled by this elastic, you know, cord. And to this day, Nicole can't really explain why she confessed, but what we've learned is that everybody has a breaking point. She was intelligent. She had a college degree, but she had just lost her child. And she was subjected to more than 24 hours of police interrogation and being held by herself in a holding cell. So I posit that under those circumstances, she was very vulnerable. And people will do what seems to make sense under the circumstances to get out of a horrible situation they're in. And if they think that agreeing to whatever the police want them to say is how they're going to get out of that interrogation room, that's what they'll do.
Yeah, and it's noted on your website in the discussion of her case how they only recorded her ultimate confession. They didn't record, say, the pre-interview and the back and forth and the exchange of information. And how important is it that when these police departments and detectives and officers are interviewing suspects, that they record the entire interaction between themselves and the suspect?
It's so important. And one of the tragedies of Nicole's case is that her case happened just a few months before the law changed in Illinois requiring the recording of the entire interrogation, not just the final statement. In fact, when the police don't record the entire interrogation, all the, you know, coercive parts of it, and all they do is record the very end when the suspect is sitting there admitting guilt. I mean, that, honestly, that's even worse. That's worse because you're just getting a tiny, very incomplete picture. But it would be very compelling, and was very compelling to a jury, to see the person sitting there admitting that, but not seeing what led up to it. And as I mentioned, in some other cases that have resulted in exonerations in Chicago, there was actual beating involved. And I think we can all understand how you might confess if somebody's beating you and telling you to confess. But what's less understandable is how psychological pressures can cause somebody to confess. And so that's why it's really important to record everything from start to finish. That's what we do here in Illinois in almost every type of case now. I think that needs to be done throughout the country. And as a matter of fact, I think it needs to be done not just for suspect interviews and interrogations, but really pretty much everything the police do should be recorded, because suspects aren't the only people who are questioned and interrogated by police. Sometimes witnesses who implicate defendants will later report that the reason they did that, they'll say, well, that was really a false account, but the reason I did that was the police threatened me, or they promised me something, or whatever. And there's sometimes no way to go back and test who's telling the truth without having the actual recording there. So I really think that would benefit everybody if we could figure out just how to record everything and how to store it and make it accessible. It's really a win-win for everyone.
And then moving to another cause of wrongful convictions, and that is the jailhouse informant. And one of the cases that you handled was the case of Randy Steidel. Can you tell me a bit about how his case unfolded?
Randy Steidel was kind of a bad boy who, not a real bad boy, but, you know, kind of a barhouse fight bad boy who lived in a small town in central Illinois. And there was a very horrible, horrible case of a double murder of a young married couple that happened. They were stabbed in their home and then their house was set on fire. This was back in 1986. And for reasons that weren't clear at the time, I have some thoughts on why this happened, that I learned about later, Randy and his acquaintance, Herb Whitlock, were targeted by the police. And, you know, I don't say this often, but I say it in this case. He was framed for these murders. And they put up, the law enforcement authorities and the prosecutor involved in the case, two witnesses to implicate Randy and Herb. I mean, these were people who you would, in real life, you would never believe anything they said. Deborah Reinbold was addicted to alcohol and drugs. She was given money. She was given leniency on criminal charges. She was pressured by police, all these things, to say that she was present for the crime when she wasn't, and implicated Randy and Herb. And she produced a knife that she says was the murder weapon, and it wasn't. That was found out later. It was actually found out later that she was at work for much of the evening. But if you give them enough inducements, people will often say anything. And so she was one of the witnesses. And the other witness, again, somebody you normally wouldn't believe, he was a severe alcoholic. People called him the town drunk, like literally the town drunk of this little town. And he was, when he was questioned by police, he was given alcohol during the questioning. And he also said that he was present at the crime scene and saw a lot of the events. Although, interestingly, that guy and Deborah Reinbold didn't see each other, even though they were both supposedly at the crime scene. But on the strength of their testimony, and just their testimony, Randy Steidel went from arrest for this double murder to death row in 4 months, which is got to be some sort of a record. And immediately after the conviction, these witnesses, because they were not telling the truth, their testimony began to fall apart. They recanted, and further investigation poked holes in their testimony. But again, Randy was on death row for a dozen years. He was in prison for 17 years. It took that long for the conviction that took only 4 months from arrest to death row to be undone, even though these witnesses honestly started to recant pretty much right after he was convicted.
Yeah, and as you said, Steidel was on death row for a number of years. He was actually, according to your website, the 18th person who had been sentenced to death in Illinois since 1977, who eventually was exonerated, and that's a big reason why Illinois eventually abolished the death penalty. And that leads, I guess, to the final issue in terms of these main causes of wrongful convictions, which is ineffective assistance. And obviously, I know you worked as an appellate defender, and Gideon versus Wainwright gives a right to counsel on direct appeal. As your website notes, ineffective assistance of counsel mainly claims that defense counsel failed to investigate eyewitnesses, alibi witnesses, etc. Those have to come on collateral appeal post-conviction. It's often many years later, and there's not in many jurisdictions that right to counsel for a post-conviction review. And so what are some jurisdictions doing, and what do you think can be done in terms of assisting these people who might have these viable claims and yet don't have representation?
Well, that is, it's just a conundrum. We get at the Center on Wrongful Convictions, we received well in excess of 3,000 letters a year from people who are mostly locked up and are seeking assistance. There's not enough assistance to go around. So in the first instance, you like to avoid wrongful convictions and ineffective assistance the first time around. And there's a number of ways to do that. First and foremost, give defense attorneys, give public defenders more resources. For the most part, they're great lawyers. They just have too many cases. Almost every public defender agency that I know of, their average caseload is well in excess of what the recommended caseload is. So it's difficult to expect them to be able to do an adequate job in every case. Just trying to reduce the number of cases that go through the system is another way of decreasing caseloads, not just for public defenders, but also prosecutors and police officers. So decriminalizing types of acts that don't need to be criminalized would be another way of reducing caseloads. But people do get convicted wrongfully, and I think we need more and better access to post-conviction representation. As you pointed out, many states don't have provisions for appointed lawyers to represent poor people who have post-conviction claims. So that needs to be stepped up. I mean, many states don't even have an avenue to raise a post-conviction claim of innocence. And I find that hard to believe, but I know it's true. There's a network that the Center on Wrongful Convictions is a part of organizations, many from legal clinics, some standalone organizations that are dedicated to providing legal representation for people with post-conviction innocence claims. I guess one more thing that's happening that I think is a really good trend is that prosecutors' offices, some of them, are starting to form units within their own offices to look at post-conviction claims of innocence. They're usually called conviction integrity units or conviction review units. And I think that's a great thing when the prosecutor's office itself is willing to open its doors to claims from people who are locked up saying, I didn't do this, please give my case another look.
You know, shifting gears for a second, one of the main reasons I was very interested in speaking to you is I think what we've seen in the popular media has been indicative of the general statistics, and that is if you look at podcasts, documentaries, etc., involving wrongful convictions, they're almost always involving men. And one thing that you've done is you've started this women's project, and it's been looking at both the unique problem that women face in trying to prove wrongful convictions and sort of some interesting features and statistics you've found in terms of cases of wrongful convictions of women. And so could you speak a little bit in terms of what you found, I guess, first of all, about some of the problems, whether it be DNA evidence, the type of crime that women face in trying to prove that they've been wrongfully convicted?
Well, I'd love to talk about that. Our women's project came about because one of our clients named Julie had been convicted of killing her son, her 10-year-old son, Joel. And after she was exonerated, she went to a national conference on wrongful convictions, and a lot of exonerees attend these conferences. She went looking for the women, and there were just like five of them and all these men. And she said, look, we've got issues that are unique to us, both in our cases and also just the way that we deal with prison and the way that we deal with post-prison healing. And so I thought about that, and I talked with her about that, came back to my office and looked at our cases. And at that time, our four clients who we'd exonerated at that time, all of them fell into that same category of being moms who'd been convicted wrongfully of killing their own child. And in none of these cases was there, again, any motive, any history of abuse by the mom, any mental illness. It was really just the proximity of the mom to the child. So something happened to the child. In two of these cases, the child was murdered by somebody else. And in two of the cases, the deaths were accidental, although they were prosecuted as murders. And none of our men's cases fell into that category at all. All of our men's cases were, you know, the more typical, you know, there was a rape or there was a murder and the wrong person was convicted. So we've been very fortunate as we've progressed with the Women's Project. There's a wonderful resource that everybody should know about. It's called the National Registry of Exonerations. So you can look at the statistics there, and they shocked me when I looked at them for women. There's not been that many women exonerated. The registry tracks convictions from 1989 to the present. And the last time I checked, which was yesterday, there were 1,783 documented exonerations from 89 until now. And of those, just 163 were women, so 9%. But you look at those cases, and the most striking one, in my opinion, is that of the women who've been exonerated in this country of crimes, two-thirds of them were convicted for crimes that never happened. An example of that is the Nicole Harris case, well, and the Christine Munch case, both cases we've already discussed a little bit. In both of those cases, their children died as a result of accidents, but both of those women were convicted of murder. And that is true of two-thirds of the women's cases on the registry, and it's only true of less than a quarter of men's cases. That's a huge difference right there. You mentioned DNA evidence. Of the cases on the registry, over 27% of men's cases, so more than a quarter of men's cases, involve some sort of DNA evidence that helped free the men. That's generally not true in women's cases, because in many of the cases where DNA helped solve the case, it was a sexual assault and male DNA is tested and the identity of the perpetrator is discovered that way. And of course, that doesn't generally apply to women's cases. Another one that I looked at recently, because I was interested in this, was forensic evidence. In over a third of women's cases, there was some sort of false or misleading forensic evidence, like arson testimony or something like that, that led to the conviction. And the number is much smaller for men, something like 20 or 21%. And I guess the last one, and this maybe this sums everything up, is that a huge percentage of women who have been proven to have been wrongfully convicted were convicted of harming or killing either a child or some other loved one in their care, maybe a grandparent or a spouse or something like that. The number is 43%. We actually count them just to keep up with that. And I can't give you a statistic for men, but it's much, much, much lower. And in a lot of those cases, the evidence that is used to implicate the woman might be scientific evidence. It might be fire science. It might be shaken baby syndrome testimony, something else along those lines. And it's, I think, harder to undo those cases many times, because to undo science-based cases, you might have to wait for a change in the science. You might have to engage a lot of very expensive scientists and other experts to testify in your client's behalf. And if what your theory is that no crime happened, that's a hard sell to a prosecutor or a court.
And I wonder, I don't know the answer to this question. Maybe you would have a better perspective on it. I know there's this Justin Ross Harris case in Georgia, which is the father who left the child in the hot car. And I had someone ask me on Twitter about, you know, how would this case be handled if it was a mother as opposed to a father? And I actually found a case where it was a mother and father who left the child in the car, and the father was exonerated and the mother was convicted. And you mentioned the Julie Ray case, where from the reporting on it, it looks like there were a lot of gendered arguments made. In fact, they were false. Like, for instance, I think her ex-husband testified that she had contemplated aborting the pregnancy with the child who ended up dying. And not only was that false, in fact, she was trying to take steps to reduce the possibility of the child not being born properly. But also, it was very much a gendered argument. And I wonder, is that something that you've seen in handling these cases under the Women's Project, that a lot of these gendered arguments are coming up a lot in the different cases that are being handled?
Absolutely. Oh my goodness, Julie's case was so infuriating in that respect. Julie's son was murdered in his bed, and she was in the house at the time, and the murderer got away. He was 10 years old, and at her first trial, the one that resulted in her conviction, as you said, evidence was put out there in a very conservative community in central Illinois, I might add, that, and it was false, by the way, but this is what her husband said, her ex-husband said, that when she found out she was pregnant, she was 18 and just gotten married, she said, oh, I should get an abortion. Well, obviously she didn't. Obviously she went on bed rest to have this child. I mean, it was 11 years later. So what was the theory there? That she wanted to have an abortion back then and she waited 11 years and then suddenly decided to stab her child to death? It was ridiculous. But just the idea that argument would be used. Another one that was evidence that was presented at her first trial, kind of similar, was, again, her ex-husband said, well, she didn't jump up and respond as quickly as he did to her son's cries in the night when he was a baby. Again, 10 years earlier. But just using what jurors and people see as the essence of a woman, which is being a good mom, and trying to show that she didn't meet those expectations, and using that to show she was a bad person and then a murderous person. The one that just absolutely killed me in that case, was that they didn't have a motive. None of these cases that I've worked on, never a motive for these moms to kill their kids. So they introduced evidence that Julie and her girlfriend were having this conversation, and her girlfriend said, oh, I'm doing some modeling. You know, some guy's been taking my pictures, and I'm doing some modeling. And Julie said, oh, I might be interested in doing that as well. And they took that, and they actually suggested that that was the motive for her to kill her 10-year-old son, to get him out of the way so she could pursue a modeling career. Now, how frivolous of a person would you have to be to even think like that? You couldn't make that argument with respect to a man. I would never, you know, can never dream about that. But that was a serious argument that was made at her first trial. Luckily, we shut that out of the second trial. But that's an example. And I could go on for a long time with a lot of different examples of prosecutors and juries relying on unladylike behaviors that they don't think fit their view of the ideal mother, and those being used against women who are on trial for their lives. And then another type of, I think, gender-influenced prosecution, this applied to another one of our clients we haven't discussed yet, Tabitha Pollack. Her daughter was murdered by her boyfriend, and she was living with her boyfriend and his family at the time that this happened. Her daughter was 3, and he murdered her. She was asleep when it happened. And she was destroyed, still is destroyed to this day. And she was convicted, charged, prosecuted, and convicted on the theory that she should have known that this guy was a danger to her daughter. Not that she did know it, because she didn't, but she should have. And, I mean, first of all, it's a ridiculous premise for a murder prosecution. But also, again, I find it hard to believe that if a mother killed her child, that a man is going to be prosecuted on that same theory. Well, he didn't know that this mom was a danger, but he should have known that. So we're going to prosecute him for murder. But there was a prosecutor in Illinois, in a particular county, who loved this theory and prosecuted a number of women, including Tabitha, based on this ridiculous theory. Fortunately, our state Supreme Court put the kibosh on that, and her conviction was thrown out. So sexism and gender stereotyping certainly finds its way into these prosecutions of women in many cases.
Now, Karen, the last question I'll ask you is, we've had a lot of listeners and people who have been watching Making a Murderer, listening to Serial, and they've been very interested. They don't have a legal background, but they're interested in doing what they can. And I'm certain that after hearing the passion with which you speak about these subjects, they'll have even more of an interest. What would you advise, you know, your average person out there? They are hearing about these wrongful convictions, these issues, they want to help, they don't really have an avenue or understand what they can do. What's the best way that your average person out there can contribute in some way to trying to give some justice to some of these people?
I think being informed and being an active citizen in your community is a great starting point. Here in Chicago, we recently had a primary election in which the sitting elected state's attorney of Cook County was unseated because the citizens of Chicago and the surrounding communities had been paying attention to what was going on in the criminal justice system, and they decided that they didn't like what they saw. And so I'm not taking a position on the election or on the state's attorney, but what I am saying is that this was a state's attorney who'd been in office for 8 years, and citizens got very active. They began protesting. They took to social media. They educated themselves, and they decided they wanted a different approach to criminal justice in this county, and they effectuated a huge change. So one thing is holding our elected officials accountable. We elect prosecutors. We elect legislators who pass laws, and pay attention to those. Pay attention to what laws are being recommended and being voted on. There are a lot of reforms that could help the criminal justice system. There are a lot of laws being passed that could hurt the criminal justice system. There's one that's been proposed now in Illinois that I just heard about that is trying to restrict the access of prison inmates to Freedom of Information Act requests to find out things that happen in their criminal cases. I have a client who's free today because he filed a Freedom of Information Act request and discovered that critical DNA evidence had been hidden from his case. He wouldn't be free if he hadn't had that opportunity. So citizens can get wind of that and call their legislators and say, vote against that. We don't want that. Fund innocence organizations. Members of Congress allocate a pool of money every year to projects to do the kind of work that I do, that my group does. So be aware of that. You might get called to be a juror someday. Don't shirk your responsibilities of being a juror. Go be a juror and be a good juror. And that's not to say don't be knee-jerk, vote one way or the other, but be an informed and engaged citizen. And some organizations have volunteer opportunities. My organization, as I mentioned, we have 3,000 plus letters every year, and we've got a small core group of really wonderful and dedicated volunteers who help us manage our mail. So that's a wonderful thing. They're not lawyers. It's data entry, but they're so devoted because they know that they're serving the greater good. And obviously, most of us are nonprofit organizations, so of course you can contribute money as well. But I think more just being aware and talking about these issues, that's going to change the culture in society, and that's what we need to do, really.
There are so many more cases that Karen Daniel has handled, but I'll mention just one more. On November 16, 1992, Jeffrey Lassiter and Sharon Hagebuck were fatally shot in an apartment on Chicago's North Side. Eight men, including 17-year-old Daniel Taylor, confessed to taking part in the crime. And all eight men, including Dion Patrick, Lewis Gardner, and Paul Phillips, implicated Taylor in their confession. But Taylor's confession was especially detailed. It involved collecting a drug debt from Lassiter and Taylor holding down Hagebuck's arms while Patrick fatally shot her at 8:43 p.m. There was just one problem for the state. Jail records showed that Taylor was arrested at 6:45 p.m. on the night of the murders for fighting in the park and was not released until 10 o'clock p.m. that night. Undaunted, though, the state claimed at trial that the jail records were wrong and they were able to secure Daniel's conviction for murder. Thereafter, two Chicago Tribune reporters began looking into the case in 2001, and they found evidence that weakened the state's case and also bolstered the claim that Taylor was in jail at the time of the murders. Prosecutors didn't care. They pointed to Taylor's long and detailed confession and said there was no way an innocent man could have made it. Finally, Karen Daniel took on the case. She learned that key evidence had never been disclosed to the defense, including handwritten notes taken by an ASA after interviewing several officers at the jail where Taylor had been held on November 16th. In addition, Daniel was able to obtain a sworn affidavit from Michael Mitchell. He was the lockup keeper on duty at 10 o'clock p.m. on November 16th, 1992, when Taylor had been released from custody. Mitchell said it was, quote, not possible that Taylor could have been released earlier. For this to have happened, according to Mitchell, numerous personnel from two separate watches would have had to conspire and work together to cover it up, and the conspiracy would have included desk personnel, lockup keepers, and watch commanders from two different shifts. Eventually, Taylor was released January 2014 based upon a finding of actual innocence. That same day, Patrick, the supposed shooter, was also released, his confession false as well. Later that year, Gardner and Phillips had the same result, their confessions deemed false confessions as well. And this is just one of many stories of false confessions that are out there. Between 1986 and 2013, 55 out of the 104 wrongful conviction cases documented in the state of Illinois rested in whole or in part upon false confessions, which is why Chicago has been dubbed the false confession capital. But these false confessions aren't limited to the Windy City. And next week, Robbie will bring you another example, next time on Undisclosed.
Thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. audio production by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the podcast Crime Writers On. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.